Right, today we're going back to the series of talks I've been doing out of book one. I'm trying to complete that set of talks. And we're going to do perhaps a talk this week and a talk maybe next week on chapter 8 from my book one, which is How to Become a Christian. And chapter 8 is entitled More Bad News, Judgment, Hell and the Lake of Fire in closer detail. So I've been looking at the whole concept that I call the bad news, which is what makes sense of the good news. So the good news is that there's an answer to the bad news, but the good news doesn't make any sense unless you know there is bad news. And so what we're going to do today and next time is look more closely at what exactly is the bad news concerning hell, the lake of fire, judgment, etc. What exactly is going to happen to us, or to people generally? So here's a few verses I've got from the beginning of that chapter. I should say, by the way, that it might occur to some people, you might wonder if I'm giving a disproportionate emphasis in these talks to things like hell and the lake of fire and judgment and bad news, as I call it. But I think you probably ought to suspend your decision on that issue until at least we finish this chapter or this series of chapters, because I'm convinced that God speaks more about these issues, these bad news issues, than I do. The only person I speak more about this than is the average church leader. The average church leader never touches these issues at all. From one year to the next, from one decade to the next. If you were to go back through the series of talks given by the pastor in most churches, not all, and you said, right, I want to know the titles of all your talks right back to 2013 or 2003 or 1993. I want 30 years of your talks to see how much you've spoken on hell, the fire, lake of fire, judgment. I am convinced that in more than 90% of cases, that pastor will not have mentioned these subjects in the last 30 years, or 20 years, or 10 years, or the last year. And if that's the case, that is neglect. The subject is being neglected. So I'm open to the charge, of course, that I might be overestimating, overemphasizing these things, giving greater focus to these issues than God gives. But I don't think I am, because I'm by no means quoting everything. There's far more that I'm not mentioning. And so, insofar as this is a preoccupation, insofar as this is a focus, or something God is very interested in, or very concerned about, or something that he has a lot to say about, well, it's plain. You know, this is not coming from me. I'm just repeating what he says. So I am not creating the emphasis. I'm following the emphasis that the Bible gives. In fact, I'm not fully bringing it out, because I would need to write a much longer chapter if I wanted to do that. So here's a few verses just to kick off with. The start of the chapter. Acts 17:31 says, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. So from God's perspective, the concept of a day of judgment is very, very important and significant, and it's very much central to the Bible message. It's a very central part of who Jesus is. And yet I think, for most of us, it's not seen as a central thing. So Jesus as a judge is not one of the main images by which he is remembered or known. You know, that's not how people see Jesus. They see him as Saviour. They see him in his earthly ministry. They see him healing people. They see him teaching people in Israel and so on. They see him in that way, but they don't see him as a judge. But we must look at him in every aspect of what he is. So being a judge is one of the things that he is. So if you knew, say, in the old days, a high court judge and who's sentenced people to death and done all sorts of things, that high court judge might also look after roses in his garden. He might also be interested in, you know, wine and gardening and who knows what else. He might also be chairman of the local, you know, horticultural society or any number of other things that he has. But one of the things that that high court judge is a high court judge. And it would be wrong to not mention that part of what he is. Wouldn't you agree? So if you're talking about a man, the Honourable Mr. Justice So-and-so, who's a High Court judge, don't you think it would be, you couldn't rightly and properly talk about him without mentioning that he's a High Court judge? So if you just mentioned, oh well, he's president of the local horticultural society, and he grows the most remarkable roses and clematis, you know, really, really are pleased with his entries for the roses this year. And you don't mention him being a high court judge. Do you see? Well, can you see that that's what we do with Jesus? We talk about him being all sorts of nice guy roles, but we don't like to talk about him in these roles. Or we don't even know that he has these roles. Some of us do know, but don't like to talk about him. Well, I believe that we have a duty to talk about whatever the Bible talks about. Anyway, here's another one. Romans 2 verse 5, it says, but because of your stubbornness and unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself in the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God. All right. Well, who's that letter addressed to? The letter to the Romans. You know, you might think, well, that this is a letter addressed to unsaved people who are going to be lost. Well, hang on a minute. This is Paul's letter to the Romans. He's not talking only, exclusively, to unsaved people who are going to be lost. I mean, some of the readers of Romans will be lost. But that isn't primarily who Paul is talking to. So Paul is saying these things to us all. These things are being said in letters and books that we all look at. Acts. I've just read from Acts. That's for all of us, isn't it? Romans is for all of us. We can't say, oh no, that's a specialist topic. That's just for a small subgroup. No, it's not. It's for everyone to know about and everyone to think about. John 3:36, it says, he who believes in the Son has eternal life. He who does not obey the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God rests upon him. So this issue of the wrath of God, the anger of God, is a part of what he is. So you might say, well, I prefer to have a God who's a nice God, who doesn't have any anger or wrath or judgment, and who doesn't, is not a consuming fire, and he doesn't, you know, smite the world and destroy parts of the world. He doesn't destroy places. He's not like that. I like a God who's not like that. See, it's not open to us to say that. You have to take God the way that he is, the way he describes himself. Do you see? And so, you know, like General Allenbrook, that was chief of staff on the British side in World War II. Now, he was a great big bird watcher. But can you see, in the same way I've been speaking, it would be a misnomer to speak of General Brooke as if what he was a bird watcher. So is it true that General Brooke was a bird watcher? Yeah. The American chiefs of staff bought him a big book on American birds for a gift and so on, because they knew about what he was interested in. But it wouldn't be right to talk of him being a bird watcher, would it? You would be telling no lie if you said he's a bird watcher, but in a sense you would be lying by just focusing only on that. You've got to focus on the whole person. So this fellow who was a bird watcher was also in charge of our war effort and was in charge of the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. Do you see? And so the analogy I'm seeking to advance is this, that we need to see Jesus the way that he really is, in his entirety, in his wholeness, in his roundness, including roles and titles and tasks and duties that don't sound nice, you know, that don't sound as nice as judging the local flower and produce show. Oh yes, Jesus will be a judge, yes, at the flower and produce, and he'll just slap everybody on the back and he'll say, you've all done very well. And that's what he'll do. Does that sound like this? The verses I've read out, does it sound like that's how it's going to be? Obviously there are some people, we know this, there are some people to whom Jesus will say, well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the rest prepared for you. Of course he'll say that to some people. But could you see, can you see, that it'd be quite inappropriate for you to say, of course Jesus will say that to me. He will say to me, well done, good and faithful servant. He'll have nothing negative to say to me. If you have that view, then one of the things I want to invite you to do is to reconsider it urgently and think again. Think very carefully. So John 5:26-27, it says, for just as the Father has life in himself, even so he gave to the Son also to have life in himself. And he gave him authority to execute judgment, because he is the Son of Man. So God the Father has given to Jesus, God the Son, the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, he's given him exclusive authority to carry out the judgment. I mean, the judgment could have been carried out by the Father or the Holy Spirit or by the Son of God, but they decided it would be carried out by Jesus, and they would not carry out the judgment. It doesn't mean that they can't or couldn't, or, but they've chosen to give it to him. Why to him? Why does he have to do the judgment? Because he's the only person in the Godhead who is also a human being and has been through what we've been through and can understand and can identify, you know, with our feelings and how difficult things are. So someone who has done the job, been a footballer, someone who's been a tennis player, knows how hard it is to play in the final of a Grand Slam tennis tournament and play for 5 hours. And who would know best how hard that is? Someone who's done it or someone who's never done it? Do you see? And so we're going to have judging as someone who's been in all the situations we've been in virtually, but who did not sin when in those positions, whereas we did. Okay. So those are just some opening remarks. So many people have heard of the phrase the day of judgment. So it's not surprising in a sense that most people view it as just one single, even brief event. But it's actually much more complicated than that. And when we speak of judgment, there are actually a number of separate judgments which take place at different times, for different reasons, and for different groups of people. So everyone will be judged, but the judgment will not be identically the same for everyone. First of all, we'll be judged in different places and for different reasons and on a different basis. And we need to identify what judgment do we think we're going to. You might say, I'm hoping not to go to any judgment, you know, but that's not available to you. And, you know, although we escape God's wrath, that doesn't mean that we escape judgment. Judgment will still come, but it needs to be carefully defined as to what it will involve. So we need to work briefly through each of these judgments that are coming and distinguish them from each other. And in particular, we need to remember that Christians will be judged separately from non-Christians and on a different basis. So the first thing that God will do at the end, one of the first things he'll do, is to separate out saved Christians from unsaved non-Christians. And in amongst the unsaved non-Christians, there will be, sadly, I'm sure of it, multitudes of people who are seem to be Christian. They go to churches, they're members of churches, they might even lead churches, but they're not saved, they're not real, they're not genuine. Okay. So anyway, the point is that there must be a separation. That's the first thing. Matthew 13:40-43, it says, "Just as the weeds are gathered and burned with fire, so will it be at the close of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all causers of sin and all evildoers, and throw them into the furnace of fire. Their men will weep and gnash their teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear." So can you see that there's a distinction here between different types of person? We'll go on to clarify it. But some people are going to shine like the sun, and some people are going to be thrown into a furnace of fire where they will weep and gnash their teeth. And you might say, well, I don't think it's a literal furnace of fire, and I don't think they'll be literally weeping and gnashing their teeth. They might just be metaphorically weeping and gnashing their teeth, and it might just be a metaphorical fire. Well, firstly, I don't agree with you, but secondly, even if it was a metaphorical fire, metaphorical teeth, metaphorical weeping, metaphorical gnashing of teeth, I still don't want to have any of it. Would you like to go to a metaphorical judgment where you're going to have all these things which God sees fit to describe in these ways, but would you like to go to that judgment based only on the idea that it's not literal, and that something very bad, which is represented by these metaphors, will happen to you, but you're going to say, but based on my premise, my thesis, my theory that it's not literal, it won't be that bad? Well, first of all, where on earth do you get the idea from that you can just change things like that? And secondly, even if that was true, which it plainly isn't, why on earth would you want this thing which is negatively described, whatever it is? Do you see? Can you see that? Why would you want any negative thing for you? I don't want anything negative. I don't want to be in a literal or a metaphorical furnace of fire. I don't want to be literally or metaphorically gnashing my teeth. I want to be shining like the sun, whatever that means. What does shining like the sun mean? Again, I think that's some kind of figure of speech. It means that people are going to be glorified. It means they're going to be happy. It means they're going to be successful. They're going to be prosperous. They're going to be blessed in so many ways. And I don't know all the ways, but I know it's a good thing. Does that make sense? It's a good thing. I want to have it, and I don't want the other. So look at this, Matthew 13:49-50. "So it will be at the close of the age. The angels will come out and separate the evil from the righteous and throw them into the furnace of fire. Their men will weep and gnash their teeth." So let's imagine you belong to the school of thought that says, oh no, this isn't literal. Well, you've got here now two separate occasions, just here, where Jesus himself personally has used these expressions. Can you see that you're placing an awful lot of reliance on a sort of surmising piece of guesswork? You're guessing and hoping that Jesus doesn't really mean it. You know, what does weep and gnash their teeth mean? Maybe Jesus means something, it's just a figure of speech. He just means where people will be mildly annoyed or mildly upset. It doesn't sound like that to me. It sounds much, much worse than that. Okay? But also, insofar as you might say, well, I don't think these people will be conscious, they won't be aware of what's happening. Well, how can you weep and gnash your teeth if you're not conscious? If you're anaesthetized, if you're out under an anaesthetic, you're not weeping and gnashing your teeth, are you? You might be having an operation or something. There's no weeping and gnashing of teeth going on because you're unconscious, you're not feeling it. Evidently, if there is weeping and gnashing of teeth, then one thing follows. There must be consciousness. So these people in the lake of fire must be conscious. So when you have on Facebook somebody dies, some pop star or somebody off of a soap opera dies, and they put rest in peace, R.I.P. Well, there's a certain sense in which the Bible speaks of rest and of sleep in death. There's a certain sense, but it means it in a particular way. What the Bible means by death is not sleep. People are wide awake and conscious after death. They immediately know what's going on. They know what's happening. It's a horrific time after death, I think, for an unbeliever. So the last two verses that I've read out from Matthew 13, they illustrate the difference between the judgment for believers, that's for the wheat, and the final judgment for unbelievers, and that's the chaff, at the end of time. But there are other aspects and stages of God's judgment as well, which occur much earlier. Now, the first type of judgment that God has brought upon us has already happened. It's already happening now. Because of the sin of Adam and Eve and the sins of all of us since then. One aspect of the judgment which is already coming upon us is the curse that came when Adam fell. Okay? In Genesis 3, 17 to 19 it says, "To Adam he said, because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return." So some aspects of the judgment that has come upon us are already in operation. So first of all, death, we all die, unless we're raptured. Except for the generation that is raptured, all of us will die. Secondly, all of us have got to face the agricultural implications of the fall and how to garden and grow vegetables and plants and fruits and flowers and things. Have you ever tried how difficult it is to garden? It's quite difficult. You're up against it. You've got opposition to everything you're trying to do, from birds, from insects, from blight, from diseases, from drought, from everything. Thorns and thistles and every kind of obstacle in your path, which I believe will be gone in the millennium when the curse will be lifted, and gardening is going to be much easier in the millennium. I'm going to enjoy it a lot more than I do now. But that's the part of the judgment that's already happening to us. We already have to die. We already have problems with our growing things. Now, would you say that the problem of growing things, oh, it's purely metaphorical. There's actually no real difficulty growing anything. Well, what gardener ever said that? That such words as that could only come from the mouth of a non-gardener. Anyone who's ever tried to run an allotment or a garden or an orchard or something knows that the curse given in Genesis 3 is real and literal and practical and has effect in tangible ways. Slugs in particular. First job of any man is to remove slugs. And first job of any woman is to run inside and get a husband when there are slugs. And that's the way it works. That's the way it works in our house anyway. So these things are real and literal. And they're not metaphorical. They're not metaphorical slugs, metaphorical pigeons that eat your cabbages. You know, they're literal. And the same, I believe, is true in relation to all the other aspects of the judgment that's coming to us. So instead of being the paradise that was originally created for the human race, and which it's going to be again in the millennium, the world is now a place of pain, of suffering, of death, injustice, and all of this is because of sin. So that curse that came upon Adam and upon all of us is in itself a form of immediate judgment here and now, right now. It's already happening. So the difficulties we experience in the natural world are the direct and indirect consequences of our sin and Adam's sin and other people's sin, which are rebounding on us. Okay? So you could say in theory, what would happen if I was not a sinner? Well, first of all, it's academic because I am a sinner. But what would happen if somehow I wasn't a sinner? I went out on my garden, my allotment, my greenhouse, my flower beds. Would they be free of the curse brought upon this earth if I wasn't a sinner? Just imagine for a minute. The answer is no. I'd still have to face those things, because even if I wasn't a sinner, which I am, the judgment has been brought upon all the race of Adam. All of us are facing this judgment. So there are innocent people in the world. There are innocent babies at 2 days old. They are subject to the curse that came upon Adam, aren't they? You see. All right. So we're already experiencing judgment in various forms right now, in the form I've just mentioned, during our mortal lives, while we're actually alive, before we die. But there will also be a number of other future judgments, and I'll cover them in more detail, I think, in other series and that I'll be doing. But the major judgment that's coming for non-Christians, the biggest judgment, is what's called the Great White Throne Judgment. But remember that there are several judgments that happen at different times and places and different groups. So let's look at the Great White Throne Judgment. Now, this is a judgment at which I hope and believe I will not be present. So I do not intend to be there when it happens, or to see it happening, or to take any part in it. That's my expectation. Not because I'm a marvellous person, but because I'm a person who's been forgiven. Do you see? As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. And he's basically buried our sin in the depths of the sea. You know, he's, though your sins be like scarlet, they should be white as snow. So because of that, my sins, which are many, have all been cancelled out. So I won't go to the great white throne. Not because I say, because I'm marvellous, but because I'm saved. And that's true of any saved person. So the Great White Throne is the largest and the most final judgment, which comes at the very end. It's the main judgment that affects all the people who are not genuine Christians. In other words, it's for all people who have not been born again, because they have not genuinely repented or not genuinely believed the gospel. And we need to be clear about that. So it doesn't only relate to people who don't believe that Jesus exists, although it does relate to them, or neither does it only relate to those who don't believe he's the Son of God, although it does relate to them. There are many people who do believe that Jesus exists, and there are many people who do believe he's the Son of God, but they're still not born again, and they're not saved. So merely to believe that Jesus exists, and merely to believe he's the Son of God, that alone, those things alone, in the absence of saving faith, in the absence of repentance, will not save you. Indeed, the very Bible tells us that even demons believe in who Jesus is. They know who Jesus is better than you do. I think the average demon has more knowledge of and more understanding of who Jesus is and what he is than you do, than I do. But they're not saved. So merely knowing who he is, merely believing in what he did alone is not enough, because they do that. They know what he did. They know what he is. That's not saving them. Neither will it save any of us who merely know what he is and what he did. So the demons know very well who he is, but they tremble when they think of him. But demons are not believers in the sense that we mean here. So knowing things doesn't make you a believer. And therefore, tragically, many people will go to the Great White Throne Judgment and then on to the Lake of Fire, even though they were what I call churchgoers, or even church leaders. There will be church leaders who I fear are not saved. Many of them. And that's because, despite all appearances, they were never real Christians. That's a frightening thought, but it's the truth. So when I use the word churchgoer, I don't mean it as a compliment. I don't mean it as something to praise the person. It usually suggests to me someone who has no genuine personal relationship with God, but who merely has the outward form of religion rather than anything real and genuine and meaningful and sincere. So churchgoers are not necessarily saved because they may never have truly repented or believed. And I've never heard a real Christian refer to himself as a churchgoer. The only people I've ever heard talk of themselves or others as churchgoers are people who, with my limited and imperfect ability to judge these matters, so I can diacrino these things, I can assess people who say these things in my limited, imperfect way, but insofar as I do that, the conclusion I arrive at, or have always arrived at, with people who call themselves churchgoers, is that they're just churchgoers. They're just people who go to a church. And as Billy Graham said, you can stand in a garage, although he called it a garage, but you can stand in a garage, but it doesn't make you a Christian, it doesn't make you a car. Standing in a church doesn't make you a Christian. You can stand in a church every week. You could put your car in a garage every day for years and years and years. You know, you could stand in a garage, but it doesn't make you into a car. Do you see? Just where the thing is doesn't make the thing into something. Where you are doesn't make you into something. So the word churchgoer is usually a word used by or used about what I call nominal, notional, name-only Christians. They attend churches and they observe all sorts of man-made traditions and rituals and liturgies, and they sing hymns and they do things and they stand up and down and they kneel down and stand up and they do all manner of things. I'm not saying this to mock anybody, because I'm not in any way mocking anybody who has any kind of liturgy that they like to do whatever. What I mean is, if all you have is that, if all you have is going to church and doing stuff, singing stuff, saying stuff, but it's not real, it's not genuine, you don't really mean it, it's not heartfelt, then it's to no avail. You know, that which you don't truly believe is not believed, and that which you haven't truly repented of isn't repented of. Ultimately, you're either genuine or you're not. You're either real or you're not, and I don't know what you are. You could be real or not real. I wouldn't know. I don't have enough discernment to know all these things. A lot of people think they've got tremendous discernment and they always know what's going on. Much of the time I don't know what's going on, and I don't feel confident that I know what other people are. I certainly hold back from forming judgments on it or from making declarations, and I never like to say to another person, "You are saved." Occasionally I will encourage a person to believe that if they're struggling with it and if I am convinced they're genuine. But I hold back from doing that because I think it is the task of the person to find that assurance. It's not my task to give assurance to people about themselves. I can give assurance to myself about myself based on biblical statements and principles. But I can't give assurance to you because I don't know what you are, because I don't have enough ability to discern. I don't know what's going on inside you. And I don't know whether you mean things. I don't know whether you're genuine. I don't know whether you're for real. You could be. You might not be. You see. So the person who is a churchgoer, as I'm calling it, is a person who's never truly repented, never truly believed, never truly put their trust in Jesus to save them in the biblical sense. See what Jesus says here in Matthew. Matthew 15, verses 7 to 9, he says, "You hypocrites, Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you. These people honour me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are but rules taught by men." And you see how Jesus goes straight for the jugular, doesn't he? He doesn't mess about. I think I am more careful about what I say, more pussyfooting around, more trying to be polite than Paul or Jesus or Peter or... The way Peter speaks directly to the chief priests, and, you know, I think I would have been a bit more polite if it was me. So insofar as you might say, the trouble with you is, you're far too vicious. You're always saying really harsh things. Whereas Jesus and Paul and Peter, they never said anything harsh. They never said anything critical of anybody. Well, what Bible are you reading? Look at this. What would you think if someone who walked up to you and the group you're in and said, "You hypocrites"? Would you say, would you give him a round of applause if he said that to you? What would you think? I mean, I don't say that to you, do I? Because I don't have the right to, because I'm a hypocrite myself, really. That's why. Why don't I talk like Jesus? Because he was perfect and he could say these things without any trace of hypocrisy in himself. So if I was to say to you, the trouble with you, this group here today, I'll tell you what's wrong with you. You've got pride. And I'd say, well, then you'd say, well, so have you. And I'd say, yeah, I'll tell you another thing. You've got selfishness. And you'd say, well, so have you. Oh, well, so another thing. You've got self-righteousness. And you'd say, well, so have you. Whatever I could think of to say to you, you'd say it to me. Well, can you see that people couldn't do that with Jesus? So Jesus could use words like that because they did not apply to him. And I couldn't walk into a group and talk like that because I don't feel qualified. I don't feel I'm at the level where I could do that. So my point is that Jesus, who is at that level, says these things. But if he says these things, and he says them about you and people like you, because the people Jesus is talking to in Matthew 15, what makes you think the people in Matthew 15 are terrible people? Not a bit like us. Really bad people. So Jesus was up against a really bad group of people that day, which is why he spoke like that. Well, these are people who've turned out to hear him. These are people who are following him around the countryside. You can't say, oh no, Jesus knows that that particular day, a group of very bad people are present in the group who are not normally there. Well, look at the way he talks on other days. He's always talking like that, isn't he? He's always saying similar things to that. So, Jesus is talking about people who appear to be believers. This is the problem. They attend church meetings, they seem to say things right, they seem to do the right things, religious sounding things, but underneath it all, they're not real. And they are in some way phony, shallow, superficial, fake. And I was one of those people myself. For the first 19 years of my life, when I was in the Roman Catholic Church, many people, I used to go to church every week. I used to be the only one out of my entire family that went every week to church with my dad. Even my mum didn't used to go every week. She started going every week when I left the Catholic Church, when I became an evangelical believer. She started going to the church, Catholic Church, every week. The rest of the family didn't go. I used to go every week with my dad. But I believe that I was not saved. I mean, that's what I believe. I don't make a judgment on everybody else who was in the building on those days. I don't know what they were. But I know I wasn't saved. But I went along. I stood there. I sang the songs. I did all the things. I did all the liturgy. I went along. I had communion and did everything that you were supposed to do. But wasn't saved because I was a church goer. Yeah, many people would have thought I was religious, which they would see as a good thing. Being religious, they'd say, is a good thing. I never call myself religious because the word religious always has negative connotations to me. It means falsely religious, as it were. I call myself a believer, or I want to be a genuine believer, a genuine Christian, a faithful Christian. That's what I want to be. But religious, no, that conveys all the wrong sort of messages. So I was in the church all those years, attending, physically present, but unsaved, unforgiven, on my way to hell and the lake of fire afterwards. So mere churchgoers, whatever denomination they belong to, may well receive, therefore, a terrible shock when they die. Have you ever thought about that? You should think about that. Think about the moment of your death. Do you ever give thought to it? What's going to happen to you at the moment of your death? What are you going to see the moment you die? What would be the first thing you'll see a second after you die? I think people will be in the room. I think Jesus will be in the room. Angels will be in the room to transport you to glory if you're a believer, or to take you to hell if you're not. The angels will take the unbeliever to hell, and the angels will take the believer to heaven. And I think they will see the person in the room when they're dying, as they die. But those who die without genuine faith, who are just churchgoers, they may discover that all their years attending church were no use, because Jesus might say to them, "I never knew you." I dread him saying that to me. I know he won't say that to me, but I would dread the idea of him saying that to me. Because those are terrible, frightening words, to have Jesus say, "I never knew you." What he means by that is, the faith that you purported to have was never genuine. The repentance that you purported to have either didn't exist or wasn't genuine. What you have is just religious observance. You're not one of mine. You're not my child. You're not saved. You're not forgiven. You're not part of the church. You're not redeemed. You're not justified. Do you see? Terrible thing to have to be said to you. So those are frightening ideas, and you should be frightened. You should think about it and be frightened. And you must assess yourself soberly and test whether you really are genuinely in the faith or just shallow and false. You've got to ask yourself about that. I don't know what you are. It's your job to know what you are. It's not your job to know what I am as such, except insofar as you might need to decide whether to listen to a word I say, because I could be talking the most amazing nonsense, and you need to come to a view on that, obviously. But concerning yourselves, you need to come to a view. Am I genuine? You saying that about yourself, not about me. I've got to ask whether I'm genuine. You've got to ask whether you're genuine. We must also ask ourselves whether we're willing to be openly identified with Jesus Christ. Are you willing to be openly identified with him? You may want to think about that. Because I think most people are not willing to be openly identified with him. Or at any rate, not in relation to any issue about which Jesus is unpopular. So people might be willing to be identified with him by having a little cross on it, a silver cross on a chain or something. That's kind of nice. It looks a bit nice. But would you be willing to be identified with him in relation to what he has to say about gender, or what he has to say about homosexuality, or what he has to say about abortion, or what Jesus has to say about fornication? Or would you be willing to identify with him and be identified as his follower on the subject of, say, Islam? Because if you want to be his follower, you would have to publicly say that Islam is false, and because that's a false religion, and you're identifying with him as the real Jesus, okay, in a genuine way. And that will, where the rubber really hits the road, is identifying with him on an issue which will bring you criticism and unpopularity and hatred even, and violence even. And those things are by no means imaginary or hypothetical or theoretical, are they? You now know, if you're living in the year 2023, you know that there are issues that can make you very unpopular if you don't say what the woke groups want you to say about homosexuality, lesbianism, you know, transgenderism, etc., etc., etc. Or even if you don't say what they want you to say about Islam. Or even if you say something about Jesus that they don't like. like Jesus is the only way to salvation. Acts 4:12, Romans 14:6. If you quote verses like that, and if you speak of him as the only way, there is no salvation except through Jesus Christ. If you say that, that makes you unpopular. So you're identifying with him in a way that will bring you the unpopularity, even the hatred of people around you. Are you willing to have hatred? Are you willing to be unpopular? And I believe most people are not. Are not willing to be unpopular, not willing to be criticized, don't want to be out of step. Most people want to fit in and just follow the crowd and do what most people are doing and don't want to be standing out like a sore thumb. I want to fit in, like kids do. I want to wear the same trainers as everybody else. I want to wear the same things as they've got. You know, that can be a problem for poor families. How do you dress your kids in a way that won't make them stand out? Because people want to fit in, don't they? Kids want to fit in, you want to fit in. People don't want to be identified with a Jesus who is biblical. They don't mind being identified with an unbiblical Jesus, but with the biblical Jesus, he's the one that gets you removed from people's Christmas card lists very fast if you identify with him. But the problem is this: if we accept him now and endorse him and identify with him, he will identify with us at the judgment. But if you deny him now in front of men, then in some way or other he will deny you in front of his Father. Now, I think he will deny us in different ways. To some people he'll say, "Depart from me, I never knew you." But I think to others, at the judgment seat of Christ, which is different from the great white throne. So just to digress, to those who are going to the judgment for believers, even them, up to a certain point, it would be possible for him to, in a certain sense, deny them if they've denied him. So I think the judgment will be conducted at many, many levels of detail. The software that Jesus will have in his own mind is so complex that he will judge you in a unique way for you, based on so many factors and issues, but one of which will be, how did you judge others? Did you show mercy to others? Did you show harshness to others? So if you showed a lot of mercy to other people in this life, Jesus will show more mercy to you when he's judging you, and vice versa if you didn't. If you always identified with him, spoke up for him, stood alongside him when it earned you ridicule and mockery, he'll stand alongside you and back you up when it counts. And that's what I want to happen. I want him to speak up for me. Look at this, Matthew 10:32-33. "Therefore, everyone who confesses me before men, I will also confess him before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny him before my Father who is in heaven." So that's primarily talking about saying, "Depart from me, I never knew you. You were never mine. You never endorsed me. You never stood alongside me. You never followed me publicly. You never allowed anyone to criticize you or hate you for my sake. What you were following was just a kind of meme or a kind of picture of me. It was a kind of flavor. It was a kind of perfume that you liked. But it wasn't the real Jesus, you see. You just liked the Jesus perfume. But you didn't want the real Jesus that would bring you unpopularity." So, the great white throne judgment will be conducted by Jesus Christ himself. It involves a far larger number of people than the judgment seat of Christ, because the judgment seat of Christ is only for the saved. It's only for saved Christians in the church. So it's not for Jews saved in the past before the church began. It's not for the tribulation saints who are saved during the tribulation after the church has left the earth. It's not for the Jews who are saved at the end, when, as we see in Romans 11, then all Israel will be saved. So one third of the whole of Israel will be saved in one day. The judgment seat of Christ is not for them. So it's not for Jews prior to the Christian era. It's not for millennial saints in the millennium who are saved, but they're not part of the church. It's not for Jews saved at the end of the tribulation. So the tribulation saints who are saved during the tribulation, they don't go to the judgment seat, neither do the Jews. Unless it's a Jew who becomes a believing Jew during the church age. Does that make sense? Then he is both a Jew and a Christian, and he will go and be part of the judgment seat of Christ, and also will be brought to Israel to live in Israel as a Jew. Do you see? We'll go into much more detail about that in the Israel series and in the prophecy series that I'll do after that. But look at the Israel series for more detail on that. So the great white throne judgment involves all people throughout all of history, right back to the time of Adam and Eve, all the way through, who have not put their trust in Jesus Christ by repenting and truly believing in him in order to be forgiven. It's every unsaved person. So it's everyone who has not gone to the earlier judgment seat of Christ, which is for the church. But after that, virtually everybody who didn't go to the judgment seat of Christ, unless they are the ones who are the tribulation saints and they're judged separately, or they are the Jews who are saved at the end of the tribulation, they'll be judged separately, then basically everybody else is going to go to the great white throne judgment. Yeah? Got it? So the judgment seat of Christ is solely for genuine believers. The great white throne is for unbelievers and believers who aren't genuine. And that's the saddest bit. So these two judgments, the judgment seat of Christ and the great white throne, they're mutually exclusive. You can't be at both. You can't shop at Asda and Tesco. You're either going to the one or the other. You can't go to both of these. Now, we don't know how many people will be at each of these two separate judgments. The numbers will be vast at both. But what we can say is that most people will go to the great white throne judgment, which is for non-Christians, non-believers, unsaved. There are many reasons for saying that, but the simplest reason for saying that would be to refer to the words of Jesus himself. And he said this in Matthew 7, 13 to 14. He says, "Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction. And those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life. And those who find it are few." Okay. So how many people are there that find life? Well, I don't know, but Jesus calls them few. Well, what does few mean? I don't know what it means. It means few. It certainly means it's a minority. So if you've got, if you had 100 people, and you said in this group of 100 people, those who have ginger hair are few. Well, what would you deduce from that? That the ginger-haired people in amongst the group of 100, well, first of all, we know for certain that they're less than 50%, because they cannot be few if they're more than 50%, can they? They have to be less than 50. But I think the word few carries with it an implication which is much more serious than just being 49.9%. To my mind, few means a small number. I don't know what number, and it'll differ in time, it'll differ according to what century you lived in, what country you lived in, etc. But broadly speaking, right across time as a whole, my guess is, I don't know, maybe 3%, 5%, 1%, maybe 10%, I don't know, are saved I hope it's a big number. I hope I'm very wrong. I hope that the way I understand things is seriously wrong, and that I've got far too strict a view of this. I hope that's the case, although I don't believe it to be so. I believe I'm looking at the words that Jesus and others have said, and I'm just soberly, calmly reading them out to you. And I can't see any other way to interpret them than as on face value of what they're saying. So we know that most people will not be saved. We don't know what numbers, but I think we can say the Bible tells us most people will not be saved, a minority will be saved, and that is whatever it is. It doesn't matter what I think the percentage is, or what you think it is. The fact is, it's not many. It's the minority. So, at the very least, we know that there'll be a majority who will go to the great white throne judgment, and on from there into the lake of fire. Okay. So we do not know how large a majority that is. We're not told. But the clear implication is of that passage is that it's a large majority, not just a token minor, a small majority. So that is, I think, real Christians are in a small minority. Not just 49 to 51, but perhaps it's 1 in 10, perhaps it's 1 in 20, perhaps it's 1 in 100. It depends where you live. So if you're living in Oklahoma, that's going to have a higher percentage of real Christians than France or Britain. Britain would have a much higher percentage than France. France is a wilderness, it's a wasteland spiritually. So nobody knows how many real Christians there are, as opposed to apparent believers or mere churchgoers. Only God knows which of us are genuine. But we can know. I believe that you can know. I believe I can know. I know whether I'm genuine. And I've examined myself very, very searchingly and very aggressively. Not quite to the level of a Robin Day interview, but, you know, pretty robust interview of myself, cross-examination, to know whether I'm genuine. There's no way for us to count the genuine people or to know what they are, because we're not competent to know the real nature of that other man's heart or his motives. Even if he sits next to us in church, even if he's been sitting next to us for years, you can't know for sure whether he's saved. You can only know what you are. And I believe you can know what you are. You just can't know what everybody else is. So there are going to be many surprises in both directions when we discover, in the end, who was genuine and who was false, and who really was a Christian and who only seemed to be. And that's I say that as a terrible warning to you to think that through. It's a dreadful prospect to think that most of the people who've ever lived on the earth will end up standing before Jesus Christ at the great white throne judgment for unbelievers. There's no way back. You can't just sort of go out through the entrance door and say, actually, I want to change my mind. I want to become a believer. It's too late then. And they'll have to give an account for all the sins that they've committed in their lives. And it's too late to change or do anything about it. Tell you what I'll do, there's no precisely obvious place to stop, but I'll stop there and we'll carry on next time on this subject of hell and the lake of fire and judgment, and we'll carry on with it then. That's all for today.